Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
The Ghost of Eugene Aram by Henry A. Herring. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Ghost of Eugene Aram by Henry A. Herring. At that time I was engaged on my well-known work on Druidical Vestiges. I wanted absolute seclusion in which to arrange my notes and write my book, and I cast about for a suitable place. I was fortunate enough to hear of an ideal spot in the heart of the broad-acred country, on the fringe of the moors and the dales, and within easy access of York withal. The house was picturesque in itself and in its position. It was situated on the edge of the great reservoir that had just been made for some distant town. It was the old manor-house of the district, and had been saved from destruction by the pleading of local antiquarians. It now stood on a little peninsula jutting into the lake, and it took my fancy at first sight. On three sides was water, on the fourth a delightful old English garden of sunflowers, box-trees, and yews. It was, I say, an ideal place for my work. The engineer had lived there for the past 5 years, superintending the building of the works, and when I looked over the house, he was busy packing up his belongings. I naturally asked him how he liked the place, and if there were any special disadvantages connected with it. To the first question, he replied that he liked it uncommonly. To the latter, he did not reply at all. I pressed for an answer, and he reluctantly admitted there was a special disadvantage. And then he added inconsequently that possibly I might call it an attraction. "My dear sir," I replied, "if I take this house, I shall be here 12 months at least, and if I find anything objectionable about the premises, it will totally upset my plans. I think you ought to give me full particulars. You really ought to be candid with me." "Well," said the engineer, "the fact is the house is haunted by the ghost of a local celebrity. I didn't mind it when I got used to it, but at first I objected to it considerably, and possibly you might never get to like it." "I do object to ghosts," I answered, "and I don't think I should ever get used to one, far less ever grow to like it. What form does this one take?" "It is the ghost of Eugene Aram," he replied. "He was born near here and lived for some time in the house. I have never heard of anyone else seeing the appearance, and haven't spoken about it to anyone but you. The thing only came when I was alone. I didn't relish its presence at all at first, but I grew to like it. You see, I was very lonely here. Most of my spare time I've had nobody but my dog with me, and the evenings are long. It's wonderful how you take to a ghost under such conditions. A man, a dog, and a ghost get on uncommonly well together in the country when they understand each other. Besides, Aram is wonderfully well informed. He isn't a chain-clanking ghost. He's a man of talent." "A murderer, I believe." "I'm afraid so. Aram swears he isn't, but the best of us might do that under the circumstances. However, he's quite harmless now, and, frankly speaking, I'm sorry to leave him." I carefully thought over the matter and finally decided to take the place, despite the incubus attached. The engineer was a man of education and taste, and if he could stand the ghost for 5 years, I ought to be able to bear the infliction for one. Besides, it would be an experience. So I fixed up the tenancy, moved books and furniture there, and commenced my work. For the next 2 months I was so busy arranging my voluminous notes that I had little time for anything else, but when at last I got them into order and had fairly started my book, I thought a little relaxation advisable. I found this in returning the friendly visits of my neighbours. Only one of the latter interested me, and that on account of his valuable library. Mr. Lee had no literary tastes himself, and he smiled at my enthusiasm about his possessions. These were at once a delight and a sorrow to me, for they had been horribly neglected. This was particularly the case with the manuscripts, which were mottled and foxed with mildew, and thickly coated with the dust of ages. It was pitiable to see them in this condition. Illuminated missals had long since lost their colouring, and the Greek, Latin, Saxon, and other manuscripts were fast becoming undecipherable. Many of them were so already. They were evidently spoils of the demolition of the neighbouring monastery, and the best preserved, and to me the most interesting, was the diary of a Priestley Pepys of the 14th century, old abbey accounts, that would scarcely have borne an auditor's scrutiny, and a bundle of monkish love letters, no doubt, mere theoretical exercises to an imaginary divinity, but evincing undoubted genius in the Ars Amatoria. Mr. Lee let me ferret at will among these treasures, and from them I hoped to get enough material for several magazine articles. This research afforded a pleasing intermission to my juridical work, which progressed apace. I well remember the evening of the day in which I completed the first chapter of my book. I was walking about my room, declaiming from the manuscript in my hands. As I ended, expressions of applause came from the fireside. I looked up in astonishment. There, sitting in the chair, was the ghost of Eugene Aram. Owing to its non-appearance, I had long since put this down to be a hallucination of the engineer, and I don't mind admitting I was startled when actually confronted by the apparition. However, I tried not to show this, and had sufficient presence of mind to reply to its applause with a casual, "I'm glad you like it." "I do. It's interesting, remarkably interesting, Mr. Smilax," said Aram. "You've a pretty talent for original research." "Thank you," I modestly replied. "Did you ever do anything in that direction?" "A little, just a little. I discovered a European affinity in Celtic roots, as possibly you remember." "I can't say that I do," I replied. "Such a fame," sighed Aram. "Nevertheless, I assure you that my discovery gained me some little distinction among the savants of my day, just as your own theories will no doubt do for you. I hope you will meet with greater recognition from posterity," he added politely. Then, in a harsh voice, "Will you kindly tell that dog of yours to stop his hideous noise?" Carlo, with bristling hair, was growling ferociously. "Down, sir, down, be quiet," I commanded, but Carlo wouldn't. For the first time in his life he disobeyed me, and I was obliged to turn him out of the room. Aram was evidently annoyed at his reception, for on my return to the room he said stiffly, "Your dog, sir, seems less well-behaved than that of your predecessor. In my own day, a cur that snarled at a gentleman was..." What happened under those particular circumstances was not forthcoming, for my housekeeper entered at that moment with sugar and hot water, and the ghost faded into nothingness before she was in view. Carlo followed at her heels, sniffing uneasily, and evidently upset by recent events. From that short and inauspicious interview began my acquaintance with Eugene Aram's ghost, an acquaintance that ripened into something approaching a friendship, and which threatened at one time to have a most disastrous influence on my career. From that night forward, Aram regularly put in an appearance whenever I was alone, and it grew to be a matter of course for me to find the intangible shade of the departed murderer seated opposite. Like the engineer, I soon got used to it, and would have regretted its absence, but Carlo never got over his first feelings of repugnance, and nightly I had to eject him from the room. Aram was indeed a wonderfully well-informed man. His knowledge of the classics was remarkable. In a weak moment I agreed to rub up my Homer with him, and he led me at a gallop through the Iliad. But he was altogether too deep and enthusiastic a linguist for me, and our first coolness arose through my objecting to learn Hebrew. "You'll be sure to find it useful sometime, Smilax," said Aram. "I simply haven't room for it in my head, and I've no wish to learn it either," I replied firmly. If you'd prefer Celtic or Arabic, I should be just as pleased to teach you," he urged. "Or we could take up Chaldee." "I don't wish to appear ungrateful, Aram," I answered, "but I can't do anything of the sort. I'm not good at languages. I only agreed to Homer to please you, and I don't understand half we read." Aram sighed regretfully. "There's little love of pure learning in these days," he said. "I wanted to read Caesar's commentaries with the engineer, but he used unnecessarily expressive language and flatly refused. I hoped better things of you, a man of literary tastes." I felt I had behaved somewhat unhandsomely, and the next night I strove to make amends by my sympathetic attention to his version of his domestic troubles, pecuniary difficulties, and all the events that culminated in his trial and sentence. He was so singularly able in his manipulation of facts, and so plausible in their interpretation, that he left me firmly convinced that if ever an innocent man was hanged, that man was Eugene Aram. It was about a month after his first appearance that conversation turned upon Mr. Lee's manuscripts and the disgraceful state in which they were. "What a pity it is they don't belong to you," said Aram after a pause. "Lee couldn't appreciate them if he tried, and he doesn't even do that." "Well, things are a bit unequally distributed," I admitted. "Don't you think intelligent men should try to remedy the inequality?" continued Aram. "If I were flesh and blood, I should certainly try to do so in this particular instance." "What do you mean?" I asked. "What I said," replied Aram as he faded away. I went to bed that night thinking over his words. Yes, it was a pity, a great pity, those priceless manuscripts should belong to a country squire who didn't even look after them. What loving care would I not give to them did they belong to me? But now they were absolutely rotting away. If they were mine, I... And so musing, I fell asleep. The next day I had arranged to run over to the Grange to continue my excerpts from the manuscripts. Never had they seemed so forlorn. I was gingerly handling one time-stained piece, Saxon it seems to me, from the faint indications of writing that were discernible, and mentally I anathematized its owner. "A confounded shame, isn't it?" said a familiar voice. I looked around, and in the daylight saw the dim outline of Aram. "Now, if I were you, I should take that home, where you can clean it up and restore it, and investigate it at your leisure. It looks like a valuable original. You could bring it back any time." He spoke so naturally and plausibly that I only saw the reasonableness of his suggestion. I could, as he said, easily take it away and clean it, and investigate it at home. Aram's help would be invaluable. Mr. Lee was away, so I couldn't ask his permission, but I would tell him what I had done next time I saw him, and he was too good-natured to consider I had taken a liberty. "Well, perhaps you're right," I said to Aram as I put the manuscript carefully in my pocket. I fancied I heard a sort of chuckle from the ghost, but on facing Aram, it appeared he was suffering from a severe cold. That evening was spent by me in removing as best I could the deposit of centuries from the manuscript and by restoring the writing from a recipe of Aram's. "Smilax," said the latter after an hour's careful and eager examination of what was thus disclosed, "you've got a find here, and no mistake. It's 11th century or early 12th, and it seems to be a continuation of the Saxon Chronicle. A northern continuation, as one can see from the verbal inflections. It's a find that will perpetuate your name, or should I say Lee's," he added unkindly. "But this is only a fragment. You must bring the other sheets, and we'll work together at them. You'll have to throw over the Druids till we've done it." "Nonsense," I replied. "What if it is as you say? This is only a philological curiosity. You can't expect me to throw over my work for it. I'm hanged if I do." Aram winced. "I don't think it very kind of you to make that remark, Smilax," he said. "If you knew what hanging meant, you would not talk about it so lightly." "I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings, Aram," I rejoined, "but I don't think you had any right to ask me to give up my work for something more congenial to your tastes." "Well, perhaps there will be no need for you to do so," he went on, "but I hope you'll help me with this chronicle in the evenings. It will be the first bit of real work I've done for 140 years, and it will be a contribution to history." Aram spoke so feelingly, and his object seemed so laudable, that with very little persuasion I agreed to his suggestion, and each time I went to the Grange I brought away with me a further portion of the manuscripts. Much of them was hopelessly illegible, but there still remained enough that could be deciphered to occupy Aram with the evenings of 3 months, and I took down his translation. I remember very well meeting Mr. Lee on his return. I had part of the precious chronicle in my pocket, just abstracted from his collection. Somehow there didn't seem an opening for telling him about it. At any rate, I said nothing. I told Aram that I hadn't mentioned the matter to Mr. Lee, and he agreed that it was quite unnecessary to do so. Mankind is never corrupted at once. Villainy is progressive, and declines from right step by step, till every regard of probity is lost, and every sense of moral obligation perishes. So said Aram at his trial, and I can, from my own experience, vouch for the accuracy of his statement, so far as it affects the purloining of old English manuscripts. Piece by piece I transferred the chronicle from Mr. Lee's possession to my own. There only remained 2 more to bring, when one night I said jokingly to Aram, "Now suppose Lee came upon me just as I was pocketing one of these things. What would you advise me to do?" "Kill him," said Aram. I stared at him in horror. "You'd have me commit murder?" I said at last. "That's it," he replied, "and you'd do it well. You're a man after my own heart." He was just a little premature. I hadn't progressed quite so far in villainy as that. Perhaps in another week I might have been ready, but I wasn't just then. Aram's speech thoroughly aroused me to the seriousness of the situation. For the first time I realized that he was slowly dragging me to perdition by his insidious suggestions. I was now a thief, possibly a confirmed thief, but there was still time to save myself from worse. I thought it all out, and before I went to sleep I had taken 2 resolves, to make restitution and to get rid of Aram. It's simply amazing how easy it is to be good if you only try. I just walked over to Lee's the next morning with a parcel under my arm. "I've been cleaning these manuscripts of yours," I said, opening the parcel and showing them. "I took them to my place to do, and I hope you don't mind." "Not at all, Mr. Smilex," said Lee cheerfully. "You can have them if they're any good to you." "You don't mean it?" I gasped. "Why, man, it's a continuation of the Saxon Chronicle." "If it had been the Sporting Chronicle, I could have appreciated it, Smilex," said Lee. "As it isn't, I'll pass it on to you, for you seem to get more amusement out of those rags than I should have thought possible." I was simply overwhelmed by the gift, and to think that Aram had actually suggested murder for its possession. "Aram," said I that night, "there'll be no need for me to kill Mr. Lee. He has given me the manuscripts." "Then all I can say is that he's just about as big a fool as you, if such a thing were possible," said Aram, and then he relapsed into moody silence. From that night one thought surged uppermost in my mind. Aram must go, before he led me into fresh mischief. But how to get rid of him? I dared not suggest he should leave the place, for I knew he would stick more closely to it than ever if he saw I wanted him to go. I don't mind admitting that previous to my meeting with Aram, I had given very little attention to ghosts. I had even doubted the existence of such things. But I could do so no longer when I was in nightly communion with one. Naturally, my interest in the whole question of post-mortem appearances was aroused, and I had resolved to go fully into the matter as soon as the Druids were off my hands. In the meantime, I had sent for a few psychical books, magazines, and pamphlets, and had discussed them with Aram. I now turned to this literature to see if it afforded me any escape from the ghost. There was an article on exorcism that interested me, but I hesitated at the services of a professional exorcist, except as a last resort, as I did not wish to make the matter public property. Then there was a column or two on incantations. I tried a few of the simpler formulae prescribed, but they did not act. They only served to irritate Aram, who got the impression it was some druidical rite I was practicing upon him. In the general matter of these numbers, there seems to be nothing that would be of immediate use to me in my difficulty, but among the advertisements, one in particular attracted my attention. Psyche and Co. Ghost and Spectre Purveyors. It ran. Mansions haunted at moderate cost. Large stock of ghosts kept. An assorted batch of crusaders just to hand. Send for catalogue. Note. Good prices given for ghosts of repute. Exchanges effected. My heart lightened as I read this singular advertisement. Here, it seems to me, was a possibility of relief. I had a ghost of repute, and if only Psyche and Co. would take charge of him, I might rid myself of the incubus. Might even be a monetary gainer by the transaction, judging from the terms of the advertisement. I wrote at once to the firm in question, and in due course came this reply. Archipelago Street, Soho. Dear Sir, in reply to your favour of yesterday's date, we are willing to purchase the ghost of the late E. Aram Esquire from you if you can satisfy us as to its authenticity. As we are rather overstocked with 18th-century revenants at the moment, we cannot offer you more than 25 guineas for its possession. Should you accept our terms, a representative will at once wait upon you to effect the removal desired. We are, dear sir, faithfully yours, Psyche and Co. Agree to the terms? Of course I would. I wrote off accepting them by that day's post, and then anxiously awaited the arrival of the firm's representative. He was a little man with large eyes, sharp nose, thin lips, and pallid cheeks. He seemed to be a smart businessman and thoroughly up in his calling. "I expect to have no difficulty at all in removing Mr. Aram," he said in reply to my first question. "I have taken the trouble of making myself acquainted with his interesting career, and I think I can offer him an inducement to transfer."
"I suppose you will have to arrange the details personally with him?" I queried.
"Certainly, and as soon as possible. You say he appears nightly. If you will tell him this evening that I specially desired to make his acquaintance, of course saying nothing about my object, you will probably be able to arrange an interview. I have no doubt whatever of the result of one. I will stay in my bedroom till you call me down."
"Aram," said I at a later hour, "a friend of mine has come today from London who is particularly desirous of meeting you. Have you any objection to his joining us now? I thought I would ask your permission."
"Just considerate of you, Smilax," sneered Aram. "Who is he?"
Then he added suspiciously, "I don't absolutely object to you, but I might to your friends."
"Well, if you don't like him, you can, fade away," I replied. "But I think you'll take to him. Try him on my recommendation, anyway."
"Well," said Aram, after a moment's reflection, "you can show him in, but no tricks, mind, or you'll suffer for it." It was certainly high time I got rid of Aram. He had never threatened me before. I called for Mr. Vigo, who entered and was introduced. The conversation began with the weather and the state of the crops. Finally, Vigo said, "Mr. Aram, perhaps your friend hasn't told you why I am here. The fact is, I want you to better your position. A ghost of your European celebrity is simply wasted here. I know a place where you would be heartily welcomed and appreciated in a manner befitting your eminence."
"Ah," said Aram suspiciously.
"I may as well be frank with you," continued Vigo. "I'm the representative of Psyche and Co. of London, who deal in articles, gentlemen like yourself."
"I know you," said Aram. "I've heard of you from friends, and it's little I know to your advantage. You make a good thing out of your employees, and yet you keep them short of pocket money and make 'em be in at dusk every night they're off duty."
"You are misinformed, Mr. Aram," said Vigo earnestly. "I assure you that any such obnoxious rules have long since been cancelled by our firm. If it were a question of hours or pocket money, I'm sure we should be able to satisfy you. However, I'm not wanting you to join our stock. I think I've got a permanent billet for you, and one that will suit you down to the ground. One of Her Majesty's judges, Mr. Justice Dormer, a hanging judge, as they call him, has just bought a fine old mansion in Devonshire, and his wife wants a ghost for it. She has applied to us herself for one, as his lordship does not approve of the idea. Now, if you would take up your residence there, you would oblige a lady and have splendid opportunities for annoying one of Her Majesty's judges. A hanging judge, I think I said. I believe you have no special reason to like them, Mr. Aram.
Aram's eyes brightened.
You're right, sir, I haven't, he said. I'll admit you have taken my fancy by what you propose. One of that kidney caused me a lot of temporary inconvenience and cut short a very promising career. I'd like to take it out of another.
King's Bench?
Queen's Bench, corrected Mr. Vigo.
Aram glided up and down in visible excitement.
I should be sorry to leave you, Smilax, he said, stopping suddenly.
Oh, don't mind me, I put in hastily. We were getting to know each other uncommonly well, Mr. Vigo, said Aram, and I was anticipating a merry time this coming Christmas. But hang me, sir, your offer suits me better. Smilax is only a poor soul, after all. I think I could do better with a hanging judge. I'll go.
My joy at this announcement almost overcame my politeness, and it was with difficulty I could fittingly express my regret at losing him.
You'll write soon, I said mechanically.
Vigo will, no doubt, said Aram grimly. And if I don't take to the job, I shall come back. Hurry up the Druids, Smilax, and don't forget the Chronicle.
Why, there are those last sheets I must stay to finish.
No, no, I cried. I can do them quite well myself. If I get stuck, I'll let you know through Mr. Vigo, and you can run over for an odd evening.
Well, said Aram doubtfully, perhaps that will do. But if you make a mess of that translation, I'll either haunt you myself or put a friend up to the job.
Stapleton Manor, Devon, did you say, Vigo?
I'll be there tomorrow night if the wind settles.
Goodbye, Smilax. Don't fret. And the ghost of Eugene Aram slowly faded out of sight. A fortnight later, I heard from Psyche & Co. that Aram had taken up his quarters in Stapleton Manor, much to the judge's indignation. A cheque for 25 guineas was enclosed in the letter. I now had leisure to resume my work on the Druids. I finished the book during the last week of my tenancy, and then I took a well-earned holiday, chiefly on the strength of Psyche's cheque, for, from a monetary point of view, the Druids were not satisfactory. I was in Algiers when I read the following in the Atlas. It is with extreme regret we have to announce the retirement from the bench of Mr. Justice Dormer, who has recently evinced undoubted signs of klepto and even homicidal mania. The matter was brought before the notice of the Lord Chancellor, who at once recognized that only one course was open. It is deeply to be regretted that the once brilliant intellect of Mr. Justice Dormer should have given way under the strain of official work, and we can only hope that the pure air and quiet seclusion of his Devonshire estate will ultimately restore him to his former mental vigour. I was sorry for Mr. Justice Dormer, very sorry, but he really ought to have had enough moral strength to resist Aram's insidious promptings. His case was indeed hopeless if his friends were relying on the Devonshire seclusion to effect a cure. I published the translation of the English Chronicle in due course. It created quite a little sensation, and my friends considered it unaccountable modesty on my part that on the title page was translated from the original manuscripts by E. A. Now, for the first time, will they understand that in this I only did justice to a brilliant, though unscrupulous, scholar. End of The Ghost of Eugene Aram.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.